Welcome to the Resilient Recruiter Podcast. I'm your host, Mark Whitby, and today we're joined by Mike Sturton. Mike is a seasoned recruitment leader who has led high-performing teams within Scotland's finance and professional services sectors. Mike has excelled at producing some of the best and highest-performing recruiters within his sector while also running a personal desk of £1 million plus. Mike has recently joined forces with BIT and is launching their financial and professional services practice in Scotland. Mike, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me, Mark.
I was trying to figure out how long we've known each other, and it's got to be at least 17 years, I'm thinking.
I think it's potentially even longer than that. Yeah, I think we're going on to over 20 now.
Wow.
You were one of the first people to coach me. Showing our age. I don't want to give too much away.
I know. It blows my mind, like, how time just...
You look exactly the same, which is the thing that...
Thank you for saying that. You look great as well.
Well, yeah, I know she didn't say I look exactly the same, though, but that's...
No, you're looking
better.
Well, my friend.
Better.
I think... So... My peak with Change Recruitment Group, which is where we overlapped, I think was around 2005, 2007, somewhere thereabouts. I was working with them. They were my biggest client. I was back and forth between the Edinburgh office, the Glasgow office, 5 to 8 days a month doing in-house training, one-to-one coaching with recruitment consultants, with managers. So I think that's when we first met, right?
That was my sort of training ground, if you like. It was a really entrepreneurial kind of base. So yeah, that was where I cut my teeth.
All right. Fantastic. So take me back though, because you started at Hays, right? How did you first get into recruiting, Mike?
Well, I didn't even know what recruitment was. I mean, hands up, I had a degree in genetics from the University of Edinburgh. And I remember it was actually my mum was saying, you need to get a job. Because I actually had convoluted story, but I had a flat and my parents guarantored my mortgage while I was a student. So my mum was basically taking away that safety net, if you like, and saying, you need to get a job because you've got a mortgage to pay. So I was one of these few kind of students that had a mortgage. And it was just before the property sector in Edinburgh really took off.
Good timing.
It was great timing.
That was a good decision.
Yeah. So I applied for every job in the newspaper it was back then, every single role. And there was a lot of recruitment jobs in the newspaper then, and my mum was an accountant, so he would go to some of the early agencies in Edinburgh were all accountancy recruiters. So I just thought a recruitment business is where you went when you were an accountant. I didn't realise there was all these different sectors. So applied for a role at with Hays, had to go through assessment centre, role plays, things like that. I remember I was the guy that turned up and everyone else was wearing suits. I didn't even have I kind of slung a tracksuit top over my arm as though it was a suit. And they took me and one other chap on. And I just took it like a duck to water. I was pretty, from day one, I kind of got the buzz.
Amazing. So different to my, I did not take to it like a duck to water. I was a bit of a late bloomer. But what was it about recruiting that you just, it clicked for you?
I think you, what I liked is I got thrown in the deep end really early. So I was able to make a lot of mistakes really early. All the cringeworthy conversations that you look back on now. But that early exposure was really, really good for me. There was a high turnover of staff at the time. Hays were just starting to win big RPO accounts. It was when they were picking up. So I was the only guy in Scotland for some of them. So I was going out to meetings with, you know, big heads of departments as a trainee. And RPO. So it was great.
Fantastic experience.
So that kind of stood me in good stead. But what I would say is that one of the things that I notice now is that I don't think sometimes people get the same opportunity as I did back then. You don't get sometimes thrown in that deep end as much as you do now. So when I've got guys on, I'm always trying to, you've got to give them the chance to fail and the chance to have those experiences if you like. If it's too prescribed an induction process and it's too slow a journey, you can't then turn around in 2 or 3 years' time and pull your hair out and say they're not experienced enough. So yeah, it was good.
Good point. Yeah, I think there's something to that. If business owners and directors are like, they're worried about losing a, like, for example, a recruiter making a mistake with an offer and, you know, losing the deal. So they take control back to close the deal, for example, and don't give the consultant that experience. But then they're always dependent on you. They're never going to be self-sufficient billers. And so it's sort of short-sighted to hold people back in their development that way.
A real big one. It's that trust. It's the trust between you and you got to trust your team.
Exactly. Let's get into this, because something that you've done spectacularly well with is building high-performing teams. So I know, for example, you've led a £3 million team of recruiters with just 5 consultants in a niche market, and they were all graduate hires. So that is an insane GP per head. First of all, that's incredibly unusual. Number two, the fact that you grew those consultants, like you really developed them from trainees. So I'd love to get into that. Can you talk about that story?
Yeah, absolutely. I should say as well, I know you push sort of exclusive retained business a lot, but actually all of that was contingent based against other agencies as well.
Even more impressive.
I think it all comes boils down to I was a big believer on. So I worked in financial services recruitment, and when you get a graduate and they have this sense of awe and they're almost a bit kind of it's almost scary for them to start to speak to these big companies. So what I used to do, I used to really just break everything down into layman's terms for them. I'd go, right, got a big bank. What's a, you know, fund managers, that's a big thing in Edinburgh. I was like, what's a fund? I was like, it's just like a big cake, and every slice of that cake is shares in a different company. Someone takes a bite of the cake, the overall value of the fund goes down. And I would just sort of relate all the disciplines to that. And then I would sort of get them to do the same with people's CVs. So we would sit down and go, right, well, this guy's the guy who puts the flour into the fund, you know. And I know that's crazy, but I would really break down the sort of training into that. I remember when I joined Hays, actually, my manager at the time gave me this massive thick book on investments and told me to read it. And I was like, I'm not got that's not going to help me fill jobs. You know, it might make me sound as though, you know, I know what I'm talking about. But I sort of encouraged the guys to really don't work a job. Don't go out to market if you don't actually understand what you're looking for. And I think that in its essence is key. And also, I used to find my management style, it was a wee bit, I like Alex Ferguson. So Alex Ferguson to me is he gets it right when you read those. I've not read any of his books or anything, but I'm aware of how he does things. And I think everyone's different and you have to manage them differently. But the one sort of common theme that you run through is that you've got to be really, really clear with your expectations of people. So any task I was given, I would always give to my team. I would always be very, very clear with what my minimum expectation was. And if people fell below that, then I would let them know about it. But any other time, I would be, if they were above the expectations or meeting it, I would step back. You know, I wouldn't be micromanaging. I'd give them their own kind of, allow them to use their own entrepreneurial spirit, if you like, to get that done and not kind of hamper them. So, and then, you know, what I was managed to have is I had this great team around me where, you know, I had one guy who was brilliant when I had to have a discussion with a client about numbers. I had somebody else who was a great account manager, you know, real great at the relationships. I had somebody else who was a real sourcing whiz kid, you know, could you could give her the hardest job in the world and she'd find somebody. It'd be like, yeah, we need a, you know, we need a cleaner that speaks French to go and work in Big Ben and on have a, you know, rope harness qualification. And she would find it. She'd always do it. So I started to have this sort of, as a leader, because everyone was able to develop what they were good at, I had this fantastic team where any problem that came in or any challenge, we always had somebody with the right mindset and the right skill set to be able to deal with that. Now, if I kind of trained them in a, you must be like this, this is the way you must be, I would just have, you know, four or five people who were identical, and that's no use to me as
and,
a leader.
And probably average as well.
And probably average. So I heard a story another recruiter was telling me. She said, you know, she worked with an agency and all her email templates for this, templates for that, templates for this. And she said, you know, my personality has been taken out of this. So, and yeah, and maybe, I mean, that's maybe something we can get into later, but
sure.
One of the things that I'm noticing just now is there's this big kind of drive with AI and everything coming in where there's a lot of skills-based recruitment going on, you know, in-house teams, AI, and it's just matching skills again. And, you know, anyone can do that. I sort of want my teams to... So I used to have this little analogy called patch. So when my team were screening CVs, I would get them to go through this sort of to see who their best, you know, who are you going to send to the client? Who's your best? He would be personality. So I have a chat with them. Are they going to get through the interview? Are they good guys? A, availability. So many fees would be lost because, I'd seen places where people just hadn't qualified the person's availability. You've got to remember, I was doing a lot of contractor stuff as well, so we'd need people in. He would be the technical stuff, right? So that's the skills-based stuff. And it's only, and the reason I would do it, I'd say, see, that's only one of five different things you should be considering. The C was the commitment, you know, do they actually want this job? You know, are you dragging them kicking and screaming to the interview? And the H was the history. And, you know, has Bob worked with Jane before and in another organization and have they clashed? You know, And I'm sort of coming back to that again because I see a lot of recruitment where it's just the T that's been looked for. You know, it's do you see what I mean? And I think a lot of there's a lot of the kind of AI things out there where they're kind of, you know, put your details in and we'll come up with the perfect match, but all it's doing is that sort of skills based matching. And
absolutely, yeah, for sure. We're big advocates of AI, but it has to be used in the right situations and applied in the right way. And so I agree 100% with what you're saying, Mike. So let's take a step back for a second. And can you tell the story of how this team developed? Like, when was this, first of all?
I left Hayes to go to Change. Change was at that time, they'd just went through an MBO, and
yes,
I think you were there. So that was a real, that was a real kind of hard foot to the pedal recruitment business. It was kind of what was needed at that time. You know, it was kind of the fast paced, stack 'em high, get 'em out. So I learned some things from that environment. And I was successful in that environment, but that was the place I made a lot of mistakes. You know, that was sort of like my, as I say, I cut my teeth there. You know, every single, and I say this to the teams, every single thing that you can, problem or issue that pops up, I would have had to have dealt with that then, you know, from, you know, sending an email to a client that was meant for a candidate, that, you know, the whole thing, getting, the whole nine yards, every single thing I could have done wrong, I did wrong in that role. But
this is the benefit, Mike, of because we've been in this industry for 20 plus years, then like you've made every mistake it's possible to make, hopefully learned from it and gotten better. So there is a huge benefit. And I mean, that's it's not fun at the time, but ultimately
I've been sitting in front of clients before and referring to, you know, their business, and then they've turned around to me and said things like, that's not what we do, you know, in a room full of people. So you know, all those sort of things. But it was, you know, you've, as I said before, you've got to go through the motions to learn. It's, that's how you gain experience. So that was really good, and I was successful, but I really kind of pushed myself quite hard, like physically, emotionally. I had a young family at the time, towards the end of my tenure, and I sort of had a financial goal. And my goal was to reach that point and leave recruitment. So it was, I wanted to pay off my mortgage, and then I wanted to get out of recruitment because I hated it, right? I was good at it, but I hated it.
Oh, I did not know that, Mike. So wait a second. Let's press pause here for a second, because I remember you at that time being very focused, very like huge drive, you know, process driven, and, you know, very confident. Actually, you came across very confident. And but what I didn't know is what you're sharing now, which is actually you had this exit strategy where you needed to make enough money, pay off your mortgage, and then leave recruitment. Why was that? Why, what made you hate it?
So they used to have this thing, the big billers sort of list, published every Friday, you know, and I was on it all the time. I was the top, you know, and I suppose it's like the pressure of how Man City feel, or a football team being number one. It's just, you know, you've got everyone when you're up there. It's, you know, people are trying to take you down. You feel the pressure to stay there. And it was, and I was just, I was putting myself under far, far, far too much pressure. And it was, and I didn't real, and that's when you said to me, you know, when I met you, you said, you know, you're not successful because of how you're working, you're successful in spite of it. So I was like, you know, has to be done, everything has to be done right away. And the output to the client was good, you know, I was getting CVs over every 5 minutes, but my ratios were probably not that great, you know, I was probably chucking things and hoping stuff stuck. So I was being a busy fool, basically. And that was why I wanted out, because I thought to be successful, I had to work like that. And I was really, really pushing myself to, I mean, you may remember even how thin I was back then. I was like,
I do remember. I remember you being pretty intense, Mike, is what I remember. You were intense.
So change, funnily enough, led to a big change. So then I exited, and it was a good day, because I remember I went to the bank and I paid my final installment on mortgage, and then I went back to change and had my notice in.
How old were you?
I was 30. My son was just born, so I was being about 31, 32.
Wow! Yeah. Imagine paying your mortgage off at 32. That's
a small house. So that the irony is, I now have a mortgage again. I was sort of a bit short sighted in the size of room my son may need as he grew up. But then I left, and my intention was actually to try and maybe set something up on my own and do it kind of a bit kind of lifestyle business. But then I caught up with, funnily enough, my colleagues I'd worked with at Hays for lunch, and they had just set up Core Asset. And what I liked about Core Asset was they were doing it the other way. They were going, right, we're going to be successful by being into, you know, using our brains really to fill these jobs. You know, we're going to properly understand what our clients need, and we're going to go out there and find the best people rather than chucking mud. So I went into, they said, look, we do a lot on permanent, we do a couple of kind of temp contracty things, but why don't you come in and, you know, see if you can help us? You know, we've got all the clients that you do, and then come here. And I thought, right, you know what? I get the autonomy to do what I want to do, but I can lean on their infrastructure and their brand, because they were starting out and I knew them, which helped. And I got a shock when I went in. They were typing out invoices, you know, it was a real startup feel. And I was like, you know, we used to have meetings at Change about they're taking a large market share. And I was actually surprised in the temp and contract side how small a market share they had. So the perception of your this is one thing I've noticed just now in recruitment, especially with everyone being online. The perception of and the positioning of your competitors compared to the reality can vary massively. So there's a lot of peacocking goes on within recruitment. And so I went in, and it was great just having a blank canvas, because I was able to take the mistakes I'd learned, change and all the process, and just have this really, really good blank canvas to put good process in, get good, you know, from things like how we structured the CV, the comments. I became a real advocate of how good, you know, if you get a job, it should never be a treasure hunt for your client when you send a CV over. So we got so good at really listing out the key criteria of a job spec, and really see, so the client would see this first. They would go, look, wow, I've asked for X, Y, and Z. I've opened John's CV, and the first thing I see is X, Y, and Z. So we became really, really good at doing that, and only through understanding the role.
Hey, Mike, let me just highlight this, because this was a while ago, right? This is, 10 years ago or longer? And that's quite a simple thing, but most recruiters still don't do that.
No, they're working too fast to just take the time to understand the role and understand someone's CV. And then also, I met a chap who was a communications guy. He was actually the guy who taught Tony Blair to stand with his hands like this. If you ever see Tony Blair talking, he was the guy here. And he was a kind of comms expert. And he said to us, he says, you know, when a human opens a document, their eye is naturally drawn to the kind of second quarter of a page. So that's where I made sure our commentary, our suitability statement was. And you know, because I was always aware, being in the kind of up against other agencies, that my clients wouldn't have time to sit and read through all the CVs. It would be a quick, and if we could kind of grab them that hook, then it would encourage them to read on. There's a lot of confirmation bias, I think, goes on with how clients screen CVs. So they'll see a CV. If they like that first thing they read, they will read on with more of a kind of positive confirmation bias in mind. If they don't like what they see, if it's just a huge garble of kitchen sink, then, you know, they'll read on the CV and look for reasons to discount it rather than look for reasons to take its interview. And that's been the crux of what I would say was my success.
That makes a lot of sense. So are you talking about, did you actually rewrite the CV, or did you just put a front page of commentary to like an executive summary?
Yeah, we would put an executive summary on. Sometimes we would have to, work on the content of the CV, but I find the content of the CV to be less important than that executive summary, for the reasons I'm saying. And it wouldn't even be an executive summary. It would be this is why Bob is great for your job. And it would be bullet pointed, you know, it wouldn't be a big long, I just am of the belief these days that with scrolling and everything, nobody takes the time to read anything anymore.
Right. True. Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So it's a bullet, it's basically a summary of why you should interview this person,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Highlights, these are the bullet points. You wanted this, this, and this. Here's specifically, like, you're showcasing how the person fits the brief.
And what a lot of recruiters do is what they'll do is just take the generic exec summary that someone's already got on their CV and just put that in that box. Whereas I wouldn't do that. I would actually take as a starting point, what was looked for on the role profile. So I would put the and then I would start with that, and then I would edit those into, you know, what the candidate had.
Yes. Fantastic. So here's a quick tip for our listeners, and this is how AI can be useful. Is first of all, we tell our clients, record every call, like especially Zoom meetings, team meetings. Make sure you're recording those. Get them transcribed, okay? Because that's going to save you tons of time when it comes to like writing up your interview notes or creating, summary. You know, what did you call them? Suitability statements for to go with the CVs. And then, of course, it's down to the skill. The AI can't do this part for you. The skill of the recruiter in asking the right questions to pull that information out of the candidate, right? But as long as you're asking those questions, they're going to go into the transcript and the AI will be able to find them later, especially if you then have a standard way that you present this information with headings and so on. And that with the right prompt, it can take what the candidate said in your interview and then stick that into your suitability statement, which of course a human being still needs to read and, you know, edit, but it can just, you know, make it much easier than the way you had to do it in the way you're describing.
Where I am now, teaming up with a great tech recruiters, those guys are, and in fact, I'll get to that, but that's one of the reasons that attracted me. I just find that I was finding that a lot of tech businesses, tech recruiters, and it may just be the industry they work in, but I was kind of drawn to, this is the future. These guys are way ahead of where some of the more stuffy corporate recruiters were.
So yes, I was definitely. Like
that was why they became kind of forefront of the companies I wanted to talk to, because I was like, and I mean, even I'll get to it, but even on my first day when they set me up in the office, they put me with two screens. And I was like, what?
You need two screens, Mike. You maybe even three.
No, I mean, you can teach an old dog some tricks, but this one was, I was like, where's my cursor going? But yeah, it's been really good. But I'll get to BIT, but they're a young.
Yeah, yeah. So listen, I really want to circle back, because one of the things, again, your kind of zone of genius is not only being a top producer yourself, but, building other top producing recruiters, right? Developing them. And so we kind of went off on a tangent there. We're coming back to building this team. So this was at Core Asset that you built this team of five consultants billing $3 million?
Yeah. So it was pretty, so the first thing is it was pretty organic growth. I think too many agencies will, you can never hire somebody unless you're setting them up for success. So I think a lot of agencies hire people speculatively, hoping that they will somehow magic an industry into recruiting, you know, that's not there. And I see that I've seen that a lot in other businesses. So I was really keen to, you know, I would always bud off, if you like. So I'd wait till the guys were flat out and go, right, we've been flat out consistently now for a good wee while. Now's the time we bring somebody else in. And so that is giving those people a platform for success. And then most of the time, if you've got a good person, your job actually as a manager is just to take that pressure off quite a lot of the time. So if you've got really good people, and funnily enough, that's what I'm noticing from my new leader, Nicola Kelly. She's really good at that. You know, if you can see somebody literally walking through walls for you, and busting their backside, your job as a leader normally is just to take that pressure off. And I had that, and that was one of the main kind of things that I would notice in that team. And also, somebody once said to me, and I think this is, might be Alex Ferguson or something that said this, but
I should probably tell our listeners that Scottish recruiters love football analogies. Yeah. So just FYI, that's who Alex Ferguson is. He's a football coach, right?
Yeah, the best of all time. But I think he once said that the best way you can get that kind of loyalty, if you like, from your players or from your team is if you set out quite clearly what your expectations are, and you make a promise, you say, if you do X, Y, and Z, I will give you this. And if you do that and they see you doing that, then you're set up for life with those individuals. It's when that promise is broken that's when everything falls apart. So I would say, right, you do A, B, and C, and I will fight at the board meetings at the end of year review, and I will fight for that promotion for you, or that setup, or if you need an extra bit of kit, you know, if you do this, that, and it's pretty much the way I parent my children as well. So it's no different. So that's kind of been the cornerstone. It's just treat people with respect, be very clear with them, be very honest, and take the pressure off them when they're really beating themselves up. I think as well, like, I think this is definitely from Alex Ferguson, but don't beat yourself up too much on the lows, and don't get too carried away with the highs.
For sure. That in recruitment is so important. In fact, I've heard Greg Savage talk about this as well, is like, when things are going great, don't think too highly of yourself or get carried away, right? You know, for sure there's skill, but you may be lifted by a great market as well. And there's other factors. So like, don't get too big an ego here. And then the flip side of that is when things go to, you know, shit, then just be nice to yourself. Don't beat yourself up too much, because, you know, then you're getting into a vicious cycle that's hard to dig back out of, in terms of managing the emotional roller coaster of recruiting. So can you give me a bit more context here? The team building $3 million, I know you're doing financial and professional services, but can you be more specific? What types of people you're placing? Was it permanent contract? What's the...
So it would be, I ran the contractor team at Core Assets, and we would position ourselves as a one-stop shop, if you like, for financial services firms. So as we got to full complement, we had a chap doing accountancy and finance within that sector. I looked after the change roles, so the kind of project guys. We had somebody doing what we would refer to as your kind of business as usual financial services roles, so pensions, investment analysts, those sort of guys, performance people. We had somebody who would do more of the risk and compliance stuff, so the regulatory things, and then someone who did business support, you know, so your HR, your marketing, your and sales sides. So when a client picked up the phone to us, they would always have somebody who was a kind of expert within that discipline. One of the reasons, though, that I made my move was because that disciplinary approach stuck to one market. I couldn't, if you like, there was no room for growth anymore within financial services in Scotland. I kind of feel that industry, they're kind of at the end of the first phase of the digital revolution, if you like, you know, and I think this is maybe across the globe, actually, where if you notice just now, you know, a lot of recruitment businesses are struggling, they're finding it tough. I don't necessarily think that's because of the economy. I believe that's just because it took us 20 years to get banks from doing things on paper to where we are now on a nice app on your phone. I mean, I can buy gold within two clicks, you know, that, and now we're there now. So we don't need squads and squads and squads of people to do that. So I don't think it's necessary. I think we're actually just back to a normal sort of level within that industry. So I kind of had a lot of candidates coming to me from that sector saying, you know, I've been around all the financial services firms in Scotland and the UK. You know, can you help me get into another sector? So I was thinking, look, I'd love to do that. So I spoke. So a good example is, I won't go into too much details, but Core Asset have X amount of clients, you know, within that sector. BIT have about 20 times the amount, because they work across lots of different sectors, including financial services. So I said, well, look, I've got these disciplinary focus. Every firm needs an accountant. Every firm needs some sort of regulatory knowledge. Every firm has a marketing side, HR, and you know, every firm has changed. So as I say, I just knew the guys at BIT were quite like-minded. I liked what they were doing. They seemed forward-thinking. They have this fantastic statement of work bit of business, which does, and it's called BIT Projects. And again, I was like, wow, this is just the direction of travel. So I teamed up with them. I took a proposition to them, and unbeknownst to me, they'd been waiting for to do that. That's why they were called B, because they wanted to be B something else. So they've got BIT, and now I'm going to be B Resourcing, as the sister company we're in the process of launching. And that's been great, because I'm now able to speak to a range of different clients. And I have to say, the financial services sector is a very, very good educator. You know, I've been trained at with the real kind of regulated industry, and they really put you through your paces. So I found that's been good to talk to other firms.
Congratulations, Mike. It sounds like an exciting partnership and opening up all kinds of possibilities, which will be mutually beneficial for you and for BIT. And so congratulations on B-Resourcing. That's phenomenal. Have you launched, or
when is launched? And we've placements out there, and we've interviews happening, so it's been really good.
Great.
I'm shortly about to announce that we're recruiting team members, actually. So
fantastic.
Anyone watching this in Scotland, any good accountancy recruiters, give me a shout.
Absolutely.
But yeah, so that's the phase we are. We're going to hard launch with the website, and some of the branding will be coming out in a month or two. So yeah, you'll start to see the brand a little more. It's amazing how long it can take. There's a joke somewhere, how many recruiters does it take to choose a color for a logo? I now have the answer to that. It's five over about 3 months.
Wow. Yeah, absolutely. Some of these things just take longer than you planned. So, well, I can see why people would want to join and be part of your team because of your leadership style and the track record you have of helping people to achieve that, you know, top level of performance. I'd still love to dig into that a little more to find out, because it's just so unusual, Mike, to have such a high performing team. And as you alluded to earlier, recruiting is not for everybody. It can be high pressure, high burnout, high turnover. A lot of trainees don't get the support, and they end up, even if they could have been good, they end up leaving the industry and feeling disillusioned with the whole thing. So, and by the way, I should give our international listeners some context. So, being a million-pound biller, which you were, while also managing, that is insane, Mike. So that it's about $1.3 million. But what people might not realize is that it's a lot harder to be a million-pound biller than a million-dollar biller. And the reason for that is the salaries in the U.S. are so much more than the salaries in the U.K. and even rates for contractors and so on, that like you have to make a lot more placements to get to a million in the UK than you do in the US. But so I just want to make sure people appreciate how big of an achievement that is.
No, I was just going to say the best achievement was actually when, you know, some of my other team members were also starting to get to those numbers as well. So the next desk down was over $500,000. But one thing I would say, and this is going back to what makes good recruiters, is that I always tell people your graph is never going to go straight like that. It's going to go whoop, 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 whoop. And as long as the kind of overall direction is up, I think people don't appreciate that. But it's two steps forward, one step back is how recruitment works. So that it took me, you know, what's that? It's taken me almost 25 years to have posted those numbers, but every year it was a little bit more, a little bit more, a little bit more. You move a company, and then you have to take a step back, and then you it's just steady baby steps all the way to where you want to be. And so the resilient recruiter, it's resilience, it's keeping going. I think that's one of the reasons I've always, although we're looking after permanent and contract now, one of the reasons I've always gravitated towards contract recruitment is because you don't have time to lick your wounds and you know, there's a new job and, you know, focus on that. It's a bit like my son's 14 now and he's playing football. And one of the things I keep saying to him, because I coach football, kids football teams as well, and our soccer teams for your American listeners. And one of the things that I notice with kids is that, you know, something bad will happen in the game, and they're still dwelling on that while the ball goes past them, you know, 5 minutes later. And you're like,
I don't think that's just kids, Mike.
Well, I noticed that,
human beings.
I noticed Ange Postecoglou, who's the Tottenham Hotspur manager. There's a clip going around just last week. He was telling his guys in the changing room, the locker room, he was saying, you know, what's next? What's next? You know, you play a pass, what are you doing next? What are you doing next? What are you doing next? So focus on that. You know, don't focus on what's happened. You can't change it. Focus on what's next. I would always get guys to do a bit of a stock take as well, right? So when I do this myself, but when you're busy and everything's flying around and you think you've got stuff, just pause, just do a stock take, you know, right, okay, I might have had 10 contractors leave this week, but I've got, you know, every day can be day one, you know, every day can be day one. So you can go, great, well, I've got 10 contractors left, but I've still got 40, you know, that's a foundation for this week, you know, or the month, I can go ahead now. And give yourself like targets that you're actually going to, that are achievable. You know, this is, so when I spoke to BIT, one of the reasons I liked them was because, and you might find, your listeners may find this crazy, but I spoke to a couple other businesses as well, large businesses, and they were asking me, and I know this is expected, but they were asking me for really detailed business plans, right? And I went to Nicola BIT and I said, you know, for year one, I'd like to just break even, you know? I said, that's my business plan. You know, let's just have that as a goal. Anything beyond that, great. We're laughing. It's an investment to start something new. If I break even year one, that's an achievable, realistic target. Now, I was going on to, my finance director used to love me because I was always under project. What are you going to do? Under project. Make life easy.
Most
for
recruiters
yourself.
Are the opposite, right?
I know.
Oh, they count deals in their pipeline that they're never going to close.
So I would always work on the worst case scenario and everything you're doing in business. Always work on a worst case scenario with your numbers. And then and that's what I've always done. Set expectations for your in the rest of your business, your manager, everyone. And I would do that with the guys as well. I would say, look, you're not going to fill, you know, give yourself an easy target. And, you know, there'd be places asking me to say, right, month three, how many contractors are you going to have out? What's going to be the margin of those? I'm like, I have no idea, you know. But I tell you what I can do for you. I can try and break even in my first year. How does that sound, guys? You know, and that's, you know, I think recruitment is a really simple thing. And a lot of people overcomplicate it.
There's a big difference between something being simple and something being easy, right? Because, so for example, a couple of years ago, I ran the Edinburgh Half Marathon. Running is pretty simple. You just put one foot in front of the other, right? But that doesn't mean that it's easy. So I just want to make sure that you're not saying that, hey, recruitment's easy. It's like...
So my wife runs. She does marathons as well. She's a really seasoned runner. She runs for Edinburgh Athletic Club. She's like sub 3 hour marathon runner. Now, but running is now easy for her. She's out just now doing 10 miles or something with the dog, who's now the second best runner in our house, not me. So our process starts off very, very complicated, and you have to go there. You have to go really complex before you can simplify. So it's okay. Like you, where you are just now, you're training and you're doing everything and it's really hard. And then over time, it does become easy. So maybe I am sort of doing that a disservice. But I do think that at its core, recruitment is, you're a matchmaker. You know, you're saying, right, you want this. I know this guy. I think you two will get on. And that's it. I think a lot of the bells and whistles of recruitment are sometimes not wholly required. And I think a lot of the, you know, the constant following up with a client when they've said, I'll come back to you, is it's just, there's a lot of busy fools in recruitment, is what I'm trying to say.
Okay, interesting, yeah. Interesting. So Mike, any other advice for billing managers who are running a desk themselves and they're trying to develop their team members, because it's been said, and I think this is true, that is the toughest job in recruiting, right? Because you're kind of split focus. You are trying to do your own thing and hit your own targets. At the same time, you're mentoring, supporting, training, managing other people. And what advice do you have? And we have quite a few of our clients in that exact same position. At the moment, they're top billers. They're now building teams and they're like brain is exploding and they're working like crazy hours.
So funnily enough, earlier in my career at Change, I used to almost plead not to be promoted. I'd be like, just give me a better commission structure. I don't need to be promoted because I didn't want that. I thought it would make life worse. But actually, the simple answer is delegate. That's what they want to learn. They want the experience. It's a win-win situation. But when you do delegate, make sure you're very, very clear on your expectations.
Okay, comes back to expectations again. So tell me the Mike Sturton process of delegating then. Like, can you give an example on how you would attack it?
Well, first of all, something comes in. You pick the best, as I say, surround yourself, not just, everyone says, oh, surround yourself with good people, but surround yourself with good people who are all offer something a bit different, you know, like the Avengers. You've got somebody with a different superpower. So that's the first thing. Who's going to be the, and it's not just that they have the experience of it. It's just whose sort of mindset is, who enjoys this sort of stuff, you know? Because I could get a thing in where a client's saying, right, you know, can you give me a report of all the contractors and all their end dates? Now, you don't give that to the guy who used to have a guy with me. He was the one you would take out, you know, take a client out for a coffee or dinner with, because he was a gregarious guy. But then you've got another chap who loves sitting around on spreadsheets all day. So, you know, you give it to that guy. One, they feel important that you've chosen them. And two, you kind of have to, you do catch more flies with honey than vinegar. So, you know, you say, look, you know, you're really good at this. I know you're good at it. You're the best person for this job. My only expectation is that we get it back by Friday to the client. Can I leave that with you? And it's that easy. So a bit of flattery, delegation with flattery and expectations.
Awesome. And so by expectations, obviously there's deadline expectations. Are there any other types of expectations you would set depending on the task?
I think that I always used to have a bit of a, we would have a really relaxed, kind of chilled out vibe environment that I had. Trust people, you're adults, work the way you like. But my expectation was always, when the chips are down, that's when I need you. So that sort of cultural expectation is something that I would set as well. I would say, you know, I see a lot of leaders in recruitment kind of go one way or the other, and they don't know that there's a middle ground. So they can either be like, right, this is the regimented way I want you to do things, and yeah, sure, things will get done, but you've got, this goes back to taking the pressure off when you can. I'm like, look, you're in a really busy job. It's going to be, you're in a job where, you know, one minute you can be sitting twiddling your thumbs and the next you're the busiest person on the planet. So enjoy those. I used to say this to my guys, look, enjoy the moments where you're quiet. Enjoy them. Spend time with your family, go for a run, you know, relax, because right around the corner, if you're doing what I expect of you, you're going to get busy again. So I would always set that expectation. But what I would always say is, if you're taking the mickey, if you're taking the mick out of it, that's when I've got a problem with you, you know. So it's that kind of hard work reward dynamic that's going on.
Fantastic. Love it. Something which you've mentioned to me before is redesigning back office operations in order to provide innovative solutions to clients. Could you speak a little on that?
Yeah, well, so going back to all the mistakes that I used to make, 50% of my time was in my early jobs was spent putting out fires that could have been avoided had I had Flickr processes. So yeah, that and that's why clients love it when I used to be on quite a lot of large, well, still am on a large corporate ESLs, if you like, for big large FTSE 100 companies, and they will audit their suppliers, you know, they will audit their supply chain. And if you go into a ESL review meeting and you've got 100% compliance, then that is great. They love that. It's almost as important as your ability to find people for them. You're a trusted partner. And I always used to think that I would always make sure my back office, and I still do, I make sure that they know, and I believe this, they are the most important people in a recruitment business. The sales team, they are the foundation on which the sales are built upon. And it's just, and I really pushed for the operations team to have a kind of bonus pool that was based upon the performance of the company.
That's a great idea.
Yeah. So you know, the better the front of house did, the better they did. So everyone was pulling in the same direction. It made for a much more harmonious environment.
I like that idea, by the way, because the front office get the glory, right? They're the ones doing the deals and they're on the leaderboard and they're getting the commissions and everything else. But of course, they couldn't do that without the back office support. So I like that bonus idea. What, when you're redesigning process, like, is it basically if a problem happens, then we go, okay, how do we prevent that from happening again? Like, and you're constantly improving and fixing things, or what's the mindset?
First of all, you have to learn from your mistakes. Absolutely. I introduced an ISO standard actually to Core Asset. So they achieved, and I designed that all myself, the business management system. And what that tells you is that there should any non-conformities, if you like, within an operation. The way that ISO works is you can't expect to be perfect all the time. That's it. But you should have a system where you can learn from your mistakes. So that it could be that there's a training need, or it could be that a process needs to be shored up a little bit. And invariably, it's normally a process that needs to be shored up a little bit. So a simple thing could be you're constantly having to tell candidates to make sure they put their overtime in a correct box on a timesheet system, right? If that keeps coming up time and time again, then obviously the comms you're sending out to your candidates on how to claim overtime aren't clear enough. So it's little things like that. So if I want to have my sales team and my operations team spending more time on proactive work instead of actually reacting all the time, that's something I need to minimize and rule out. And there will always be a way of doing it. So I always remember my dad's an engineering background. He's a process improvement guy. So he got he's a Six Sigma black belt. So they're all okay about process. And I always remember him. He says, "Well, I went into a banking organization, and I was to look at kind of processes that weren't needed." And he says he noticed that there was a team in one side of the office would do all this do all this work on checks, all this office on checks, and then they would carry these checks to another guy at the other side of the office, who would then take all the staples out and put them in two separate trays. And my dad was like, "Well, you know, just sit there. If we just sit them next to each other, we've saved the business about, you know, 5 minutes a day of this guy walking, or 5 minutes a trip walking backwards and forwards." So there's a lot of things like that in recruitment. I think you should always map your processes, because and you should do it every few years as well, because, you know, you get a new client, so there's a bolt on, there's a new system in place, there's another bolt on. So always kind of have a chance to just map it out, and then you can really see all the opportunities to kind of improve things or automate things as is happening these days, you know?
Exactly. In fact, this is like 101. This is one of the things we get all our clients to do. One of the first things we get them to do is map out your entire recruiting process. Like, how does it currently work, right? What are you doing, right? Because a lot of people are, it's all up here, but they don't have it documented anywhere. And so that allows you, number one, to make sure that you're delivering consistently and producing predictable outcomes. Number two, it means that you can then train other people on how to follow your process. And number three, and therefore you can't really delegate something if it's not, you know, if it's just in your head and it's not documented anywhere. Number three is you can identify areas to improve that process, because maybe there's certain things you're doing which could be upgraded or are not even needed. And number four is some of those steps could be automated and, you know, just make the whole thing more efficient, save time so that people can concentrate on that proactive work you're describing. So I think that's super valuable.
I have another one, Mark. Number five, if you ever plan on selling your business,
right,
it's also very helpful if you've got all your processes documented, if ever you're doing a sale.
Definitely. Really, yeah, good. Absolutely. Five reasons to document your recruiting process.
Recruitment leaders out there.
Great. And so be resourcing. What's the vision? What have you got planned?
The vision
apart from
is,
breaking even in year one.
Yeah, I mean, we're going to be identical to BIT. So those in Scotland will know BIT is a fantastic brand within the tech space. So we're identical in terms of the way we work, our ethics, our values. That really chimes. The only difference is going to be the disciplines that we work in. So we're taking that out to their clients, as I mentioned before, professional and financial services. So it's exciting. I think the future of recruitment I think it's at a really good point just now, because we've noticed the demand for that human element of recruitment rather than just skills-based recruitment that's kind of dominated the last few years. So we are heavily invested in AI to help us do that job, but we're also one of BIT's kind of values is be connected, and the other one's be brave. So we look to be connected. That's why I reached out to you actually after all this time. I thought I'll catch up with Mark. And we look to be brave. So we go out there, we speak to clients, we consult. It's just been really, really good because I'm out there consulting now, which has been fantastic. So that's the future. And as I say, I'm building a team around with the same sort of kind of values and management style that I mentioned before. And it's been really well received so far with the clients we've been speaking to. So it's exciting times. Even though I will be even fatter next time you see me, as I comfort eat at my desk.
Well, and I believe the BIT guys have a podcast as well, don't they?
Yeah, so my colleague Michael Fair has it's a Talking with Tech Leaders podcast. So he speaks to a lot of the kind of CTOs around Scotland, and it's quite interesting to see the challenges that those businesses are having. It's even though it's tech, it's quite similar to a lot of different businesses.
So sure.
Same things, same themes throughout.
It's a smart strategy. We've helped probably 10 plus recruiting firms launch a podcast. It's such a great way it's a fantastic vehicle for marketing, but also just for learning and learning about your industry and your clients and having those, you, like when you say be connected, it's a great way of connecting with really interesting and influential people, who you would normally not get access to, right? It's hard. Some of these people that you aspire to know or connect with or do business with or network with are, you know, they're, as a recruiter, it's hard to get their attention, but having a podcast and inviting them to be on your show is kind of it circumvents a lot of the challenges of getting a hold of people.
It's also good to see where they all started out. So that's what I like hearing about is, like, you know, everyone's human. They've all started out in you know, those entry level roles. Nobody just walked into a CTO job out of school. So I think that's good for our candidates to see that. You know, this is, keep going. So that resilience. The resilience in recruitment, you need it in any job, really. That's what I'm trying to kind of sort of preach to the kids in my family. They're all doing their kind of exams that sort of age just now, and that sort of resilience to keep going is something that's really, really important. So yeah, so any resilient recruiters out there, give us a shout.
Fantastic. Mike, this has been really fun. I'm so glad we got to catch up today.
Yeah, me too, Mark.
All right, and good luck with resourcing. You'll need to come back and give us an update at some point.
I'd be delighted to do that. Yeah.
All right. Fantastic. Thanks. Have an awesome weekend.
And you. Thanks.